Okay, let's start. So most welcome here to the London School of Economics and this public event on the new approaches of the Belt and Road initiatives. So we are most delighted to have Professor Huang Renwei from Fudan University, one of China's absolute top universities. He's also the Executive Vice Director of the Fudan Institute of Belt and Road and Global Governance. So, and we're going to spend some time talking about the Belt and Road initiative, but first just want to say very welcome here, and we are delighted also that we are starting a new chapter in the Fudan-LSE relationship, that we are starting a Fudan program that will be housed actually at the School of Public Policy in this building. As you probably know, the School of Public Policy has now moved here to this building, and the Fudan program will be based in this building. So it's very appropriate that we are here. So the Belt and Road Initiative is an evolving concept. It has had many names, exactly. So many names, and of course, to some extent, reflecting the changing nature of the initiative. And it started, I think, focusing on a very particular part of the world, but it has expanded. And we probably will have some discussion about, whether this is a good or a bad thing. But the last count I saw was 152 countries now are, in one way or another, part of this Belt and Road Initiative. So in that sense, it's a success as a concept, and many countries have, in one way or another, bought into it. It, of course, it's also an approach to development that raises a lot of interesting questions. How should China become part of global development and global governance? It, of course, also a challenge to other countries. How will they approach development, and how will they raise their game in terms of supporting global development? So I think all these issues, you will give us some guidance, and then we have maybe some questions, you and I, and then we'll open it up for discussion with the whole group. So I'm very much honored to have you here, and look forward to your presentation. I think you can see there are many options to look at the screens or look at these screens here. So please, Professor Huang, you are also, actually, I should have said that you are also an expert on American history, which may be quite relevant when you discuss also the Belt and Road Initiative. So please, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Professor. I should use this side.
Okay, very good.
Wait. This side. Okay, yes. It's too far, maybe?
No, it's perfect.
Okay.
It works.
Okay, it's a work. Thank you. Good evening. It's my great honor to have this chance to give a presentation to our friend in LSE. This is a very famous institute in China. Every scholar would be great honor to have presentation here. So thank you, Professor, give me this chance. And for saving time, I should give a very brief introduction about Belt and Road initiatives. And this is the map of the world, and I saw the global, the Earth in this corner, but upside down, so different from this map. We can see The Belt and the Road, on the whole, is across the Euro-Asia continent from the east coastline from China to the west end of the Europe continent. This is the major way of the Belt and the Road. It can be divided into three parts, the northern line and the central line and the southern line. It's the land bridges of Belt and the Road. And also, it has maritime Silk Road from South China Sea to Malacca to Indo-Ocean and the Red Sea to Mediterranean, and also from this side to Malacca to Australia, New Zealand, and South America. Sometimes it can go in the north from to this pole until northern Europe. But this is not very much can be used in only maybe several months a year. So the major part is this part, Euro-Asia and the Indo-Pacific region. And for my own study, I don't want to say what the whole picture is. I could be sometime prefer to divide into several blocks, like Southeast Asia blocks of Belt and Road, South Asia blocks, North Asia blocks, Central Asia blocks, Middle East blocks, Central Eastern Europe, and Sub-Saharan Africa, and Southern Asia, Southern Pacific region, and the Southern American region. People say, why no, not North America? Depend, maybe 10 years later. Okay, I don't give too much details region by region. I just give you the whole picture. Might be 10 different regions. Originally, this Belt and Road initiative was initiated in 2013. The September and October of 2013, when Xi Jinping was in Indonesia and Kazakhstan, he in the, these two countries he initiated Belt and Road Economic Belt, that is belt in Kazakhstan, and he raised the initiative of Maritime Silk Road in Indonesia. So this is the road, so Belt and Road from these two initiatives. So it's already 6 years since the very beginning, but this year Xi Jinping raised a new concept that is jointly building Belt and Road. Also, co-construction of Belt and Road. So it's moving from initiative to construction, from China's leading role to multilateral construction. So it is a little bit changing. Also, this Belt and Road initiative is combined with the new opening strategy of China, that is, China is an open market to outside more than only export to outside. So now it is going to be import and output two-way opening, not only one-way opening. And the capital in last 30 years mostly flow into China. Now its capital flow outside to China, inbound and outbound the same time. So two ways, the commodity going to two ways and the capital going into two ways. And the second is now China is going to be more rule-based opening. In last 30 years, sometime we just go very, you see, sometime Chinese enterprises can do anything they like. But now we should be very observing the international rules. intellectual property rights may be the number one what we should observe. And more opening for the service market. And originally it was monopolized by the state-owned enterprises. So these are new opening strategy in China. It is combined with Belt and Road. As you know, from early last year till now, more than 1.5 years, we have been experienced a new trade friction between China and the U.S. So this is a serious problem we are facing. But if you see the total volume of China's international trade is still growing up, even with the background of China-U.S. trade frictions. Why? Because we have more export to the Belt and Road countries. So the trade with Belt and Road countries, the growing of this part can make up the loss of the market from U.S., our export to U.S. So it is a new balance. So we can see there are two different markets for China's international trade and international investment. One is all the traditional developed economies. The other is new emerging and developing economies along the Belt and Road. So these are two different markets, two different resources, and sometimes different rules. And now China is trying to have a higher quality development of Belt and Road. That is, we should take care these different items or projects in Belt and Road. We should think about the industrial parks, not only the infrastructure network. Later on, I can give you more examples about industrial parks and different industrial chains, how China's industry is moving to outside and how make the local government, local economy develop more rapidly and how make the projects more profitable, more return. Okay. And also the investment in Belt and Road, we should change the model from the only sovereignty funds to market capital. So this is one change. And also from Chinese capital to more international capital. More European or Japanese capital can be part of Belt and Road. And also international financial institutions like ADB, like World Bank, also the new international institutions like AIIB, so work together. Also, the transparency could be improved. Originally, mostly these projects only open to China companies, but later on, I think it will be open to the international business people. And the last 5 years, we mostly focus on the hard projects. That means railroad, high-speed highways, high-speed railroads, deep water port, airport, or power station, these kind of things. These are all hard projects. But next period, we might have more soft projects, like education, health, environmental protection, tourists, these things. You see, make this balance, it will be more benefit for these local people. Not only high projects to combine, to link China port to Indonesia, maybe there's harder projects, sometimes very big, averagely one project about $1 billion. But soft projects may be very small amount of money, maybe several millions, one project. Several million US dollar, one project. So 1 billion or 1 million, this is the different size. And the people to people, because if we work with different countries along Belt and Road, we will face different cultures, religions, social problems, all kind of things. So this is challenge for China. Also, mostly these Chinese companies, enterprises, they have little knowledge about the local culture and the social organizations. So not only money can be workable, sometimes money doesn't work. And also, we should think of the local political situation. Sometimes they have two-party competition. One party was the rule party, another party was opposition group. Then 2 years later, changed the party positions, and they will change the policy toward the Belt and Road, or the project might be stopped sometime. So these are new challenges, and we should be more capable to deal with these challenges. Also, the environmental, ecological factors will be very important. Terrorism will be a danger, and international crime, refugee, illegal immigrants, and public health, many disease, trans-border disease. If there is no infrastructure of highways or railways, the disease is just local. If it's linked with more countries, why? Sorry. Okay. Oh, yes. You use this. So we need some regional governance along Belt and Road. So it's related with global governance. If the global governance is too high, too empty, too hollow, but the regional governance linked with Belt and Road will be very operationable and concretely be carried out. So Belt and Road is the laboratory of regional governance. And it can be more materialization. We can see like AIIB, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, these are new mechanism of multilateral institutions. And we also use so-called third-party cooperation, like Japan. Japan was very active on infrastructure in Asia. But when Belt and Road Initiative started, Japan lost its role as originally it played. Now we are trying to ask Japan be the third party to join this Belt and Road. Also, we ask EU be part of third party to join together. And we also make some sub-regional or smaller sub-regional multilateral mechanism. If you know, there is a river between China to Southeast Asia called the Mekong River. But in Chinese part, it's called the Lantang River. So we call the Lantang Mekong River Area Valley Governance. So it's a new changing of this regional cooperation. Okay, there will be very vivid or hopeful new development of multilateralization along Belt and Road. It's too much I can talk because these things too much in details. But if you have questions, I can answer you. Because they are region by region. Every region you can talk more than 1 hour. So I just stop here. These are different regions, Southeast Asia, South Asia, Central Asia, Northeast Asia, and the Middle East. All these 10 different regions. So I just stop here. And also we should think of the digital Silk Road. Because last 5 years, we didn't think of digital Silk Road. But this year, since China's company Huawei is the leading player of 5G communication technology, so we should think of combine 5G with Belt and Road. So if Belt and Road can be a digital Silk Road, it will be a great change in the world. These are different cases. Some are quite successes. Gwadar in Pakistan. These different ports. And then I visited all these cases. I had been go along. I did some field survey in Pakistan from Xinjiang to Gwadar port. It was about 2,000 kilometers long. I visited Indonesia. There is a project called Jakarta-Bandung High Speed Railroad. I visited Bangkok, Thailand. There is a new highway between Thailand to Yunnan province, Kunming City. So I just try to find what's happened, really happened along these projects. Are they successful or are they failure? So conclusion. So mostly Chinese researchers or institutions doing micro strategic studies of Belt and Road, then micro enterprises or business level research. So in Fudan, we are trying to focus on micro cases studies, then macro strategic studies. So we have made more than 40 cases studies. So I think China should think of a new way of bilateral progress. Make it shorter, smaller, softer, then bigger, greater, harder. Okay, you understand what I mean? And the long term will be very successful. I'm very optimistic. But short term, more challenges, because we are later comer of global governance. We are learner, learn more than dominate this kind of region. So next 5 or 10 years will be the critical period of bilateral. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Huang. So I thought we would have a few questions back and forth, and then we open it up. So multilateral came back many times in your presentation, and you seem to shift away a little bit from sort of a global multilateralism to more a regional multilateralism. And so that would be one question. Is that what you have in mind? And also, you didn't really talk about some of the major institutions like the China Development Bank, for example. Do you see them as participants in sort of a multilateral system, or are they a complement to the multilateral engagement through AIB and so on? How do you, what is your vision of multilateralism, and maybe explain why you have a certain vision?
very challenging questions, and this is, I think, what we are facing. We have many challenges. This is one of more complicated questions. Firstly, global governance is not only what China initiated. It started by developed economies and countries in the Europe and the U.S. But interestingly, after Trump's administration came into White House, it's quit from many institutions of global governance. So there are many new fields or old fields without U.S. participation. So it gave China some opportunity to join or to play some kind of role in global governance. Then, I presented just now, then came out to the bilateral. We suddenly find bilateral is not only projects of infrastructure. If you want to build different projects, you should combine with the conditions of local government, local countries, and local social system situation. So this is so-called local governance. But bilateral is more than local. It is cross-border with several countries or a sub-region to work together. So we should ask more countries work together, not only. Sometimes one project takes 3 or 5 countries together. So it needs the multilateral institutions to cooperate with each other in longer period. Even after the construction of projects, you should manage to operate these projects, like highway, like railway, high-speed railroad, or power station. You transport this power from one side to the other side. If we say China-US train, China-Europe train from East Coast line of China to west part of Europe, we may go solo more than 10 countries. So it is the necessity of the multilateral organizations on Belt and Road. Then people will ask why you want to build this Belt and Road to spend so much money. You see, it's interesting. As the World Bank and many global international organizations estimated, more than 10 or 100 trillion US dollars should be invested in infrastructure network global wide. But no money can be put in if China not leading the way. So China has already invested more than 200 billion US dollar. But 200 billion US dollar comparing with 100 trillion US dollar, still very, very small amount, maybe only 1% of the actual demand of investment in global infrastructure. So this is a new stage of globalization. This new stage called globalization will change the structure or the location of the industrial chains and the international investment. So China just leading the way. China has no this capability to take care of all the trillions of dollars. So multilateral organization or institutions is very, very important, and China should think the other way. We initiated this Belt and Road, but it's not belong to China, it's belong to the world. This is what Xi Jinping said this year. So our thinking, I think, a little changed.
So
this is the first question.
Yes, and the second question is, how do you see, for example, the China Development Bank?
Even in our inside of China, we should think. The first model was the National Development Bank, also we call China Development Bank. It has spent, I said, more than 200 billion to outside of China, and more than 200 projects. So averagely, one project about 1 billion US dollar. It's very big. Like in Pakistan, we invested about 20 billion, only 22 projects. You see, this is what China National Development Bank have done. But we have another model that is Asian Investment Infrastructure Investment Bank, just called AIIB. This is a very internationalized, multiplied international financial bank. And more than 60 members, including Britain. Britain leading the way of developed economy to join this AIIB. And in this model, always use the rule of World Bank and ADB, Asian Development Bank. And all the projects are transparent to outside with to these member of the bank. And till now, it has no independent projects. Always follow international organizations who open new projects along Belt and Road. So now you can see two different models, AIIB model and the National Development Bank model. So which model will be more promising in longer term? I think AIIB will be more promising. But Chinese National Development Bank still will play major role in next 5 or 10 years, but it will be more balanced.
Maybe one more question on and you touched on it several times, this we talk about decoupling, trying to separate China from sort of vulnerabilities to measures by the United States in the ongoing trade war. How do you see this playing out in the Belt and Road Initiative? You already alluded to that the global governance will be more difficult, but you mentioned some of the projects here where there are participating companies that are clearly subject to pressures from the United States. How do you see this playing out? Will we have a parallel structures appearing? Will you be forced into a sort of more unilateral approach because of these pressures?
The term of decoupling, not created by China. No. It's created by Trump administration. With the trade war or trade friction between China and U.S. going on in last 1.5 years, U.S. pressed China tougher and tougher and try to, also we can say, de-link U.S. and China to markets interdependence. And actually, it could not be realized because these two markets are too big to decouple. China annually export to U.S. more than $500 billion. U.S. export to China about $200 billion. But U.S. has surplus in service market, service trade, about $100 billion. So both, no matter U.S. or China, cannot lose the other side for the market. Even in investment, U.S. has already invested in China $400 billion. China has invested in U.S. market more than $200 billion. So who can pull out all this money invested in the other side? So actually, decoupling is not be realized. I don't think it will be the reality. But partly can be true, especially in high technology areas. U.S. stopped the supply chain in chips or other high-tech products. So this might happen in short term. But if U.S. cut all the supply chains from U.S. to China, then will China really stop these kind of products? No, because EU, Britain, and Japan, even Israel, will play and fill the gap what the U.S. Give up. So U.S. will lose the market in China. You see, it's not their opportunity, but their in long term will be their lose. So decoupling in technology area will be, I think, in short term will be realized. In longer term, it will change back. And then another decoupling is software, like WTO. If US quit from WTO and set up a new World Trade Organization among those developed economies and cut China, cut India, cut all the emerging economies, is it possible? I don't think so. So decoupling is only the term of protectionist in some part of White House. Even in White House, they have differences. So it's only a short-term phenomenon.
You mentioned that you have focused a lot at your institute at Fudan on looking at concrete cases, the specific product. Is there one product that sort of stands out for illustrating some of the problems with the Belt and Road Initiative? Is one that you would just to give, because we're talking in very abstract terms here, we talk about billions of dollars and
yes.
Quite complex
I give you one or two examples. Mm-hmm. Like a guava pot. Many people believe guava pot is somewhere there won't be any real development, just an empty pot there. But
explain where this is for the audience.
Because you see, you can find the pot of Karachi, the old pot there. So it's not necessary to have a new pot there.
We're talking Pakistan.
Yeah. But when we visited the Gwadar pot,
yeah.
It was 2 years ago. Mm. Now it's much better. Even 2 years ago, they had a new industrial park. Mm-hmm. China used the experience in Suzhou or in Shenzhen to have this new industrial park, and all the infrastructure in this park was completed 2 years ago. And 100 companies have been moved in. So it was fully filled with 100 enterprises. Now it is the second stage of the industrial park. Another 3 industrial companies are going to be there. So we call the Gwadar Port as the new Shenzhen of Pakistan. In next 10 years, you can see a new Shenzhen in Pakistan. And many Chinese companies there, they employed Pakistan laborers. You know the hair, hair? It is electronic it is a very famous label in China. Mm-hmm. It's moved part of its production in Pakistan, employed about 20,000 workers there. So I think also even in Thailand, we are also moving more and more industrial production lines, assembly lines to Thailand. So these are new development, more than the highway, railroad themselves. I think industrial lines, industrial chains are more important than just the infrastructure.
So one problem that, one criticism against the Belt and Road Initiative is that countries that are benefit or part of this are encouraged to take on debt that will not be sustainable.
Call the trap of debt.
Yes, and debt traps. And Pakistan arguably has some of those issues and had to go to the IMF recently and so on to get support. How do you see that, and what do you think is China's role and responsibility in this?
It's a very hot topic in Western media called debt trap or trap of debt. Interestingly, even in Financial Times, it was the earliest report on this topic. And I talked with the editor of Financial Times. I say, what's your concept of debt? You put if we take Pakistan as example, 200 million or 200, no, 20 billion US dollar from China to Pakistan, then 5% of this amount was our international assistance to Pakistan. It's not that. We won't ask Pakistan to pay back. And another 20% are government loan to Pakistan. This is that. But even in this part, you can see different kind of loans. Zero interest rate, or low interest rate, or periodically payback payment, or sometimes even we wiped out these loans. So this 20%, they are debt, but even very small, if divided into years, only no more than 100 million payback to China each year. And another 75% are investment from Chinese companies to Pakistan. So investment are not that. Investment should be taken care of by the Chinese companies themselves. If we build a power station, then we can get back from Pakistan local consumers. They pay for their consumption of the power. If we build a highway, the cars, the automobiles should pay for the transportation. So in next 30 years, we may get back this investment, and we will transfer the ownership to Pakistan, called the building operation and the transfer, BOT. So 75% are not debt. So you put all these together, call them debt. They are not debt at all. Only no more than 20% are debt. Another 80% are not debt.
It's okay. Of course a matter of definition, but yes. But would you think that China should accept IMF's definitions of what's debt and what's limits on debt sustainability?
So we should be realistic. What is really debt? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also another case I can give you, Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka got $10 billion US dollar from China. Also can be divided into different structure. But before China's investment to Sri Lanka, there were about $30 billion US dollar debt from Western country to Sri Lanka. But no one talk about Western debt. Just talk about $10 billion Chinese investment as debt. So Sri Lanka, the debt of debt trap of Sri Lanka, actually are those Western loans. So these are strange argument.
Okay, so now I want to open up the floor, and anyone. Please introduce yourself and who you are and where you come from. So please.
Hi, my name is Ahmed. I work as a consultant. So, I mean, when you were describing the debt issue of the...
Please use the microphone. Sorry, I should have said that. So we don't have any roving mics. So please, if you can, use the microphone.
Hi, my name is Ahmed. I work as a consultant. I'm really interested in your argument about the debt issue. From the way you describe the Belt and Road Initiative debt schemes, whichever they are, because you said there's several ones, they all seem to be like the subprime schemes that the U.S. had for different kind of houses, and ultimately that turned into financial crisis because, you know, so much debt and risk was into the system being built up. And it seems that the Belt and Road Initiative is just doing that, just asking more people to take more debt, which we already know they're not going to be able to pay it. And maybe in 10, 15 years, China will realize a lot of people can pay these debts. And then the question remains, are we faced with another financial crisis that is originated in Chinese loans? Because people can't repay these debts because there's not enough growth or whichever thing theoretically could happen that would prevent them from repaying these loans. So you are criticizing Western financialization, but you're doing it yourself. So it seems to be a contradiction.
Okay, I'll collect a few questions and then, so please. Can you introduce yourself, sir?
Sure. I'm a master's student here now. Previously, I worked in commodity research. I think one of the barriers to the understanding and therefore acceptance of the Belt and Road Initiative in certain countries is its decentralization. And so it's being put forward by many different state bodies, many different local governments, and many different individual firms. And you have lots of projects managed by different bodies. In your view, is this the case? Do you agree with me that this is a barrier? And do you think the relevant authorities in China agree? And are they taking measures against that? And to follow on from that, do you not think that with more small, soft projects, that will compound the issue? Because this links to transparency as well. As if you have one big project and one managing it, that's inherently easier to understand and sort of more transparent than many projects and many institutions. So that links to transparency as well, yeah.
Okay, please.
Do I have to? Oh. Hi, my name is Anna. I'm doing a master's in global affairs in King's. I appreciate that with this talk with the BRI, has created a lot of jobs and contributed to poverty alleviation. And within the BRI, you have stated that with the China-Myanmar economic corridor includes the Jiaxing town, which obviously is a port through China transports a pipeline for oil from the Middle East to Yunnan. And a 2012 report by the American Oil Watch stated that the health of thousands of people will be endangered by Jiaxing's economic involvement with the Belt and Road Initiative, and also destroy Myanmar's second largest mangrove forest. And so as we know, Rakhine's already an area of extreme poverty and civil unrest. So are there any approaches that the Chinese government is taking to ensure that the environmental safety and the rights of the locals are not overwhelmed by China's economic interests?
Okay, so we had some more explanation on the debt trap and how you see this risk that countries go deeper into debt and China facilitates that. You had the idea, the challenge that there are authorities at different levels in the Chinese regional and local structures and small projects may create more less transparency, and now this issue of how to deal with many of these issues around big projects and working with non-governmental organizations and so on. So maybe you take them in whatever order you want to.
Okay. The first question, yours, will China's investment or economic projects along Belt and Road cause those countries some kind of financial crisis? I don't think so. You know, from 1990s, many financial crises happened in developing countries, mostly not by direct investment, but by those hot money. When the hot money flow into the developing economies, they're booming up. When the hot money flow out, the bubble suddenly pull down, then the financial crisis happened. But all the money from China to those Belt and Road countries are direct, real investment. Those are not hot money. So they want to go, suddenly go in, then suddenly leave. So these are another reason of financial crisis. It is related with, but what do you mean? I guess it's related with the budget problem or the fiscal situation of local government. So it can be some kind of fiscal crisis more than financial crisis, okay? Fiscal is not different, it's different from financial, okay? But the fiscal problems depend on the budget problem of the government of the host country. Then China and the local government should discuss how pay back until they have this capability. Not China force them to pay. So I give you a case. That is the Indonesia high-speed railroad in Indonesia, Jakarta-Bandung high-speed railroad. It will be completed next year and will be operational the end of next year. We believe it will be profitable and it will be returned totally in next 30 years. So we have a plan with Indonesia government to periodically pay back in next 30 years. So the capability of payment depend on the budget capability of local government. We want to force them to say, if you cannot pay, you should do what? It's not our China's way to.
But you do acknowledge that there are procedures for dealing with this issue. I mean, there is the frameworks that the IMF, for example, provides, and maybe primarily IMF. You want to work within that framework, right?
Yeah. And so-called transparency. I said first stage, meaning projects mostly carried out by Chinese companies. Mm. But I mean that now we are moving into second period. So the second period, it will be more transparent, more multilateral. Mm. So, and also these smaller projects, I also gave the example of Pakistan. Sometimes it's very difficult because the Pakistan, the political parties in power, they decide where the project should be, where money should put in. Then the former Pakistan government concentrated the money in one province, and the other provinces could not get enough projects. And the opposition, the new party came out, say it's not fair. We should move some projects to other provinces. So this is their domestic political struggle. It really gave us some difficulty for China. So now the new projects in Pakistan all moved to those provinces who had no projects before. So make some balance. Also in Malaysia, the same cases. So then we believe the bigger projects could not, you see, separate very easily. So smaller projects can you see, in Pakistan, we are building more hospitals, schools, and environmental protection. To make the local people be benefited in short term. Also, transparency. I think if we work with Japan, we should put the project openly, say Japan and China, how to work together. Not only one company from China. If we work with EU in Central Europe, Hungary or Serbia, we should open the project with EU. So I think this new stage, transparency will be much more strengthened than before. And the third question is Myanmar. Myanmar, there are a lot of NGO in Myanmar. Mostly those NGO related with environmental questions, ecological questions, and also stopped a great project of a dam, a power station. So it's stopped there. And also the pipeline of the oil and the gas, it's already working now, import oil and the gas to China. I think the problem of environmental protection, we will go based on the international standard. If this project is really violate the international standard, we should stop it. If it's not really the standard, we not go beyond the standard, we can keep on its operation. But the NGOs in Myanmar, I think they are too much, maybe thousand and thousand NGOs there. So I don't know how many NGOs in Myanmar are really working for Myanmar's development for their local people. I'm working with Yunnan province. We sent our groups to Myanmar. And you know, Myanmar local people are very welcome China's companies invest capital there. Even a small city along the border of Myanmar and China called Reili, the city, there are 100,000 Myanmar laborers working in Reili. They are pouring into Reili and really open to them. And many Chinese companies move their factories from Beijing and Chengdu and Chongqing to Reili. So it's a win-win. Really, economic growth very fast. And local Myanmar people got their job. Hundreds of thousands of them, you see. So I think Myanmar-China corridor is very, I think it's very good for Myanmar people. And even very difficult for their ethnic groups there. You know, the Muslim in along the border of Bangladesh and Myanmar. They are now moving to the border between Myanmar and China. We should take care of them. So sometime with the Belt and Road, China should show them more responsibility than before, you see.
Okay. You mentioned all these, I mean, you say thousands of NGOs in Myanmar. How do you see China? You know, China is not used to working with NGOs in this. How do you see that being organized, and how do you?
Yeah, so I think China should have our own NGO. Okay.
One.
Yeah, very little, very little. Maybe sometime we have more NGO in Myanmar to debate with those international NGO in Myanmar. Otherwise, if only China embassy in Myanmar to talk with thousand NGOs in Myanmar, it's not fair. And the people don't believe you are official agencies. We are NGOs. It's not equal.
you want to have a Belt and Road NGO in
this country. I hope so.
Yeah. Okay. More questions? Yes, please.
Okay, so I'm a postgraduate student at AOSE studying China studies. So do you think there is some like military purpose or the national security purpose behind the One Belt, One Road initiative? Because like the port at Pakistan, so it probably could secure the oil supply for China, which of course will trigger other countries' concerns such as India. So how do you think about this phenomenon? Thank you very much.
Yes. You have to press down the button.
I have two questions. First one is
please introduce yourself.
So I have two questions.
One question.
Okay. My name is Ze Jian, and I'm from St. Lawrence University. I'm an undergraduate student, and my first question is that as many factories moved out from China and went to the Pakistan, like Patalco port to employ local people. Will that really affect the domestic, like China domestically, the unemployment rate? Because as we say in the US, when many big companies moved out of the US, so many US people are unemployed because they are company are moved out, they have no jobs. Will that happen in China if Chinese domestic companies move out of China? So China's unemployment rate will increase. That's the first question. And second question
there are so many questions here, so let's keep it to one question. Okay, thank you.
Hi, Richie Dillon, HSBC. What political solution do you think there is to the Chinese and US trade issues? Is there a political solution, or will it take a different president, or what will happen?
Okay, so we take those three questions, and maybe on the first one, which is about other security considerations in behind the Belt and Road. Also, maybe you can say something about the need to create security arrangements. Once you start investing a lot of money and resources into individual countries, you need to find ways of protecting them. And how do you deal with that?
This is called geopolitical factors of Belt and Road. Yeah. Some people suspicion China has geopolitical purpose or security background. This is some kind of, I think, old thinking. When in the later 19th century and the early 20th century, when Germany and Great Britain competing in Middle East by different plans of railroad, so it caused the strategic competition. And is China going to do the same thing? I don't think so. When I talk about 10 different regions, can China use Belt and Road in all these 10 regions for strategic geopolitical purpose? It's too big for China to see all these regions as our spheres of influence. It is only market, the world economy. I said this is a great demand of investment of infrastructure. We're just leading the way to make full use of this demand. It is good for China's growth of economy. It is great for China's export. You see, if we built a railroad, high-speed railroad, then the equipment of the railroad should be exported from China, okay? If we set up a new industrial park, a lot of Chinese factories can make their new factory in these parks. So these are only economic consideration. But many Western, especially US, believe it is control the part like India, say it is a chain of pearl. Chain of pearl, that means one part is one pearl, then put them together to circle India. It depends on the local country. If Sri Lanka doesn't want to be any kind of part of the circle of India, it's no use. If Indonesia or Malaysia, they just want to be more benefit from the high-speed railroad. They don't want this railroad to be militarized. So if the local country don't want to be the military allies of China, China could not use this for military use. See, it's not China can control. China can decide.
But even if you don't, so if you take the point of view that this did not have any security considerations behind it, but once you have made this investment, you must be worried about.
This is another kind of security.
Yeah.
It's if you say terrorism attack, yeah. How China be safe? How China company or China labors be safe? So we should one work with the military forces of local government. Mm-hmm. They can protect us. Mm-hmm. Second, we can employ private security forces, international companies of security, of safety. And third, China can organize the private security companies for China's enterprises. So these not strategic military forces. It's only personal safety. So it's different concept of security. Okay? And the US is now use Indo-Pacific strategy more than Asia-Pacific now. So it is changing its geopolitical deployment and strategy. But China is not go along with this kind of US strategic adjustment. So we ask US to join us, but US say, no, I won't join you. Okay? So it should take time. What China is really doing for bilateral should be proved by facts, not by old traditional security thinking. Okay. And another two questions.
One question was on the the offshoring of jobs. And,
yeah.
And are you threatening employment in China?
We say this is so-called going out.
Going out, yes.
Going out of China's companies. If the cost, the labor cost, the land cost, the resources and the material cost higher than the factory can be afford in China, they should move out. Like Bangladesh, you know Bangladesh now is the largest country, largest export of clothes of outside of China. Those factories of textile all moved from China. So Bangladesh is the lowest cost for labor. So now China even import clothes from Bangladesh, not export to Bangladesh.
But are you worried about the sort of popular reaction against that?
Then China should upgrade our industries. So there are like Guangdong, the Pearl Harbor, Pearl River Delta. Now it's moving upgrade. It's industrial, no more the toys, the textile in Guangdong. Mm. They all moved out. But the Guangdong still the biggest economy in China. You see? What's wrong? Huawei, those high-tech companies moved in. So it depends. If you have no higher industries, then move out means less job. If you have new high-speed, high-standard industries, then move out is good for local economic development. Okay?
And then the big question.
U.S.-China trade war. Will it be negotiable? It depends on Trump, President Trump. He changed it day by day. Okay? He said today, he suddenly said, we can negotiate a new agreement. Tomorrow, he said, no, I will put higher tariff rate to 25%. Totally, $500 billion export to China, from China. Okay? He changed it too much. So I wish the agreement can be reached early next year or the end of this year. But I'm not sure because Trump will change so much. But if he won't be sure the agreement be reached early next year, then next year the presidential campaign will be disturbed by the by trade war between two countries. And the economic cycle is going down. The stock market will going down. Put them together. We seriously disturb Trump's campaign for his president election. So he needs the new agreement of trade with China more than we need. I believe so.
So he has to open up a new front in this trade war by talking about the possibilities of forcing Chinese companies to decouple in the sense of the financial system.
So you're right. Maybe from trade war to financial war.
Yes.
But it also will disturb U.S. economy too. So
probably there, probably more China than.
Yeah, the stock market will will up and down very seriously. So it will also the agriculture products in the farming states of U.S. more than 50 states will seriously impact on the vote of Republican candidate. So I don't think if Trump want to win the election, he must have the agreement with China. If he don't care about the election, he can keep on the trade war forever.
More questions?
Hello. I'm a master's student of international relations at Queen Mary. I have a question related to you just listed out several successful projects of the BRI, but as far as I know, there are some projects that raised skepticism among those invested countries. Let's take the case of Vietnam, for example, the Hanoi Metro, which was delayed so many times. And regarding this issue, do the Chinese government have any measure to streamline the process of this project in specific on and those projects which were delayed so many times like this in general? Thank you.
So I understand you're saying, is it China's government playing some role in which projects are being implemented or how they are being implemented?
They are being implemented.
Okay. Yeah.
And I'm a sixth form studying A levels, and I've got a question about the Uyghurs, the Uyghur Muslims, Xinjiang. So in Xinjiang, China's cracking down on Uyghur Muslims by placing over 1 million of them in re-education camps. In reports of organ harvesting, Human Rights Watch says that Uyghurs are subject to intense surveillance and are made to give DNA and biometric samples. In camps, they are forced to renounce their faith and drink alcohol and eat pork, which goes against their Muslim faith. Is China taking all these measures against the Uyghurs because of the importance of the region for the Belt and Road Initiative, as Xinjiang is the gateway to Central Asia?
Okay. I'm back there.
Hi, I'm Katz Business School. Yeah, would you say the global image of China and the Belt and Road Initiative is troubled and hurt by fake news? And if it is, would you say the Chinese government will it ask the companies involved to somehow solve the problem in the relative countries?
I don't catch this. No. So the question is, so fake news is affecting, I think, the trade war or also maybe the perception of the Belt and Road Initiative. Will China take measures to influence those companies that work in this sort of social media space or communication space? We can think of examples, maybe. Okay.
Yeah. Three questions are very challenging. And I don't know the case, what you said in Vietnam. But on the whole, Vietnam is not active to participate in Belt and Road. Mm-hmm. It is very hesitant, very cautious to join Belt and Road. But recently, I was in Hanoi two weeks ago, talking with the scholars in Hanoi National University. They believe they are too late to join Belt and Road. They believe Vietnam, because Vietnam don't trust China, so they don't want to put infrastructure construction in the China's investment. So they, even the subway construction in Ho Chi Minh City or in Hanoi, they ask Republic of Korea or Japan to do this project. Mm-hmm. But too high cost and too slow speed. Mm-hmm. With 3 years or 4 years without any complete construction. And they saw Laos and Cambodia and Malaysia got new projects from China and very quickly completed. They said, we are making some mistake. So I don't know the case you mentioned, but on the whole, Vietnam is changing its attitude recently. I believe in next year, more Belt and Road project will be put into Vietnam infrastructure building. Even some Chinese companies move into Vietnam with the background of China-US trade friction. We still support Vietnam in the infrastructure construction. No problem. So the leader in Hanoi, the Vietnamese leaders, now is talking with China on Belt and Road. The question about the Uyghur, it's the very sensitive question in China. But the most important thing is Xinjiang more safety or less safety than before? I think Xinjiang now is very safety now. Maybe 3 or 4 years ago, it was very risky. In Xinjiang, many people killed or hurt by some extreme Muslim there. So like outside, many people believe we put many Uyghurs into prison. Actually not. But there is or there are several thousand or 10,000 of these Uyghur people put into training. How to train them to have the capability of new job. And after 1 year or half year training, they found a new job, let them go out. So this period of training is very different judgment. It depends on the behavior, not depend on their face.
But maybe for this discussion now, is, you know, this problems in Xinjiang, you see the treatment being a reflection of the importance of the Belt and Road Initiative. I think that's the basis.
Yeah. Xinjiang is very important with Belt and Road, because if we go to Central Asia, we must go through Xinjiang. If sometime even we go to Pakistan, we must go through Xinjiang. And I went to the mountain, Kala Kunlun, every day about 300 or 500 container cars, container trucks, go through these mountains. And the drivers are from Xinjiang. They can go every day in and out of Xinjiang. And the Pakistan trucks only in Pakistan, not to move to China. But the China trucks can move to Pakistan. This is what Pakistan-China corridor really is. And the highway between Xinjiang and Pakistan, the condition is very good. You know, it is sometimes more than 5,000 meters higher. And the largest truck of containers, more than 10 meters long. It take very, it need a very big turning curve. So Xinjiang, we should, firstly, we should put security first. Stop any kind of terrorism in Xinjiang. Then we should develop economy. Then we should open its economy and the society to outside. So these are the different purpose, different tasks.
In terms, so the last question here on
fake
here.
News. Yeah. There are a lot of rumors and different stories of Bandero along the medias. So in my institute, we have Bandero media studies.
Okay.
Yes, and we try to collect all kind of media reports along Bandero. And we find the positive reports are growing up more and more year by year. And the negative reports are reducing. So it takes time to ask outside understand the better real. So we don't worry about these fake news, because rumors always rumors. Even sometimes people will say, if in Pakistan, only two Chinese workers killed by terrorism. But in China, many Chinese people themselves believe many Chinese laborers killed in Pakistan. So in China, also we have rumors about Belt and Road. So you cannot ask foreigners, say everything should be true. Okay? Take it easy.
Can I, so I'll ask you a last question. So you're a scholar of American history.
Yeah.
And of course, the last time we saw a sort of transition from one hegemon to another was in the end of the 19th century. And it was a essentially peaceful transition. If you look at that experience, what do you think China can learn from that experience?
Yes. U.S. is the only one take over the hegemony from Great Britain. Yeah. And Germany failed, Japan failed, Soviet Union failed. So some U.S. Political scientists and international studies like Professor Ellison in Harvard raised the concept of Thucydides trap.
The Thucydides trap.
Yeah. This concept all based on the last 400 years old history. They don't think of the globalization. They don't think of the new factors of technology and the communication, these kind of new factors. So China is not German in First World War, is not Japan in Second World War, is not the Soviet Union in Cold War. We are totally different from these three challenges. U.S., when U.S. take over British leadership, three things. One is British, that time was too weak to support its colonial system. Second, British was seriously damaged by the German Nazi attack. Third is British owned great money from US. So British say, okay, I move this leadership to you. But more important is US, British had the same values and the political system. What China should learn from US, that is, US didn't challenge British like Germany and Japan. China don't want to, China does not want to challenge US. Even till now, when Trump asked China, give China so much serious pressure, China still don't want to challenge US. And we still want to open our economy, our market to US. And only in this field, the U.S. give up their leadership. We say, okay, we can supply some kind of public good. So I think we learn from U.S. what U.S. helped Britain in First and Second World War. We will help U.S. in the economic, when U.S. have economic difficulty, we can help them. Okay. The time, the historical period is different now. So in the 2008 to 2011 financial crisis, we supported U.S. In 9/11 crisis, we supported the U.S. Next, if U.S. has a new crisis, we still will support U.S. Believe me.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Huang. It's been a pleasure to listen to your very insightful reflections of the on the Belt and Road Initiative. And I think it's clear that this is still an evolving phenomenon, an evolving initiative. You actually used plural. You said initiatives. So it's several things, and they, of course, together form some kind of totality. and you know, China is constantly facing new challenges as it develops this initiative. So we will follow this with great interest here, and again, very welcome here to LSE, and we look forward to working with Fudan.
Thank you.
So please applause for the speakers.
Thank you. Thank you very much.